Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Scoop. I'm your host, Frank Chaparro, Director of Special Projects at The Block, and I'm very excited to have joining us on the other side of the mic, Muneeb Ali, CEO of Trust Machines and co-founder of Stax. I don't know why. I feel like you've been on the show before because we've had so many interesting conversations over the past half decade, from regulation to tech, but I'm pretty sure this is the first time we've had you on. Obviously, we have to have you on with, you know, Stax up over 50% over the last month and everything happening with Bitcoin. Thanks for joining the program.
For sure. No, great to be here.
So let's sort of just maybe for folks who are unfamiliar with the ecosystem and your story, let's just give them the TLDR on Stax and Trust Machines as a company sort of helping support the growth of that ecosystem.
Sure. So I think people should think of Stax as a Bitcoin L2. And it started in like late 2017. I think 2017 was a bull market year. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin fees actually went up a lot. And it made very clear to some of the devs. So I was building on like Bitcoin L1 back then. Like, so mm-hmm. my career started in Bitcoin like around 2013 when I was finishing my PhD. And I have the battle scars to show, right? Like if you tried building on the Bitcoin L1 and then the fees go up on you like they did in 2017 and you realize that this thing is never going to scale, right? Like it's crystal clear to you. So I think that's when Lightning started. Mm-hmm. That's when Stax started late 2017. And we sort of like raised capital and did some R&D because in the Bitcoin culture, I think there's a lot of focus on safety as well, right? So one of the big things in Stax is we wanted to come up with safer programming languages. So that resulted in Clarity. And the mainnet went live in 2021, early 2021. I think, honestly, I would say we were a couple of years too early. Like even in 2021, yes, we got some traction. We maybe got devs. But the broader industry, like I don't think they were as tuned in on why a Bitcoin L2 or why these things are important as they are now. Like now really seems like the time where Bitcoin L2s are emerging as a category. And in some ways that it worked out for us, right? Like sure, we were a couple of years too early, but it gave us like real world data. For example, the launch in 2021, we realized that running at Bitcoin speed is not going to work for normal users, right? Like 10 to 40 minutes for a block, and our L2 blocks were timed with Bitcoin blocks. So we realized that hey, the L2 blocks would have to be significantly faster, and also figuring out how to get a lot of BTC liquidity from L1 to L2 turned out to be a very, very important thing, and being able to do that in a safe way. So those two things have been a focus area over the last year or two. And this ecosystem also decentralized a lot. So I'm trying to pack like several years into a mm-hmm. couple of lines, but Stax was also the first project that did a SEC qualified offering, which meant that, you know, anyone, even regular people in the U.S. could actually participate in the initial offering. But then that also meant that we had to decentralize very, very explicitly, right? So Stax, sort of like the initial entity was dismantled in several ways. It still exists in another shape or form, but there's several other independent players in the ecosystem. And that's where I think Trust Machine comes in. So I, with my co-founder, raised fresh capital into an entity where we are like, hey, there's an opportunity for building something like a consensus for Bitcoin, where, yes, Bitcoin doesn't have a lot of functionality on the L1, but with L2s like Stax, we can actually build interesting protocols or web wallets or, mm-hmm. or security protocols and so on that we are working on at Trust Machines. And I think let me pause there because then there's interesting stuff that happened last year with Ordinals that sort of like kickstarted all of this.
Well, I think you guys put out a report that kind of described it as a renaissance in Bitcoin's building culture, which I think is a pretty well said. I had a conversation with an investor in I don't know if he invested in Stax or if he invested in Trust Machines, the entity, but he described you as being incredibly tenacious. There's nothing that's going to stop this guy from trying to make this work. And it's been I think you described the journey quite well. It was impressive to fit in half a decade into a few minutes. But let's start with sort of, let's think about Bitcoin and then we can get into Stacks and maybe what Trust Machines is doing. What is the state of Bitcoin right now? And when we think about how it's changed culturally, to what extent did Ordinals maybe open up Pandora's box and making us think about this crypto differently?
Yeah. So I think on the point of, you know, sort of being tenacious or stubborn, I do think that at the low point, so let's call it like, you know, 2022 or something, I remember like being at this dinner for founders, and this friend of mine, I won't name him, but he sort of like jokingly intros me as, hey, meet Muneeb. He's the only person building on Bitcoin. And everyone sort of like laughs. And I also laugh. And the reason why I laugh, because it was so sad, but also true, right? Like I think that moment captures the state of building on Bitcoin. It's basically, I think, again, I'm trying to compress like a long series of events into like short sentences. But in 2017, when Ethereum launched, under a lot of criticism from sort of like OG Bitcoiners, which are sort of like my original circles. Mm-hmm. And these people were also going through an internal civil war, right? Where Bitcoin forks were happening and people were starting Bitcoin Cash and big blocks, small blocks, all those arguments. At that time, I was for small blocks on Bitcoin alone. And the arguments were all about, hey, you don't need to change Bitcoin. Bitcoin is just money. Like, take all of this stuff away. And Ethereum was welcoming all the developers. And I think that was a big fork in the road. Mm. So since 2017, and then there's always a fresh crop of people who join Bitcoin every year. So I think year after year, the people who came, especially in like 2018, 19, 2020, later on, they were getting their information from like podcasters and this relatively new crop of Bitcoiners who are not coming from the original crowd, like the people who believe in decentralization, in a Bitcoin like circular economy or building things on Bitcoin and so on. And it became very much like a religious cult. And I think I've been on the receiving end of it. And interestingly, like what I was doing was pissing off both the Bitcoin, let's call them, you know, Bitcoin monetary maximalists and the Ethereum people. Like if you tell Ethereum people that, look, Ethereum is great, but it's not money, it's never going to be money, and we want to build the Ethereum like tech on top of Bitcoin, they'll get offended. They're like, no, you guys, it's never going to work. Like, Ethereum is where the action is. And the Bitcoin people will get offended that don't try to do these things on top of Bitcoin, right? So that was sort of like the criticism stage. But with Ordinals, I think it was very interesting because A, Bitcoin didn't have to change at all. Like Ordinals launch and you can't do anything about it, even if you hate it. Mm-hmm. So all of these folks were sort of like yelling and complaining and crying, but there was user demand, right? Like there was developer demand, capital started coming in. And I do think a lot of the work that we did was sort of like setting the stage for something like this to take off, because we realized that, you know, we need to start developer communities in Bitcoin. We need to start developer conferences. We had our own like Twitter spaces, and there was a community that was like ready to, or even like web wallets or new types of tooling, like indexers and whatnot. So, and a lot of the Stacks L2 people jumped in to start supporting Ordinals on the L1, which is a very interesting dynamic, because we could actually see that the more usage the L1 gets, the more obvious it becomes to everyone that you need the L2s, right? And so that was a very interesting dynamic that emerged. And then I think Ordinals is the thing that sort of like broke the culture. I would say they're, so when I compare this to the Bitcoin Cash or the Civil War, mm-hmm. I think it was much more intense because you were forking the chain itself, right? So there was more confusion and mm-hmm. more sort of like intense things going on. This was very interesting. No one was forking Bitcoin, the chain, but you were just forking the culture. Mm. Right? And both cultures can actually try to survive on the same underlying chain. And then I do think one of them has started dominating more. If you just look at things like, you know, even simple things like Twitter spaces, there will be some maximalist top of like Twitter space going on, and then there will be Ordinals one going on, and the Ordinals one is more interesting, and a lot more people are actually listening and coming in and joining the Bitcoin builders culture, which I find super fascinating.
How does sort of the breakout of Ordinals translate into people maybe being more comfortable with the idea of layer two on Bitcoin, building on Bitcoin generally?
Yeah. So I think I would say that in the call them the dark ages, like, you know, 2017 to 2022, basically, if the community is, it depends on, like, you know, how the sort of like the leaders, and it's a decentralized community, so it's not like there's like one leader, there are several people who have more influence. It really depends on like how they behave. Like if you look at Ethereum and you look at Vitalik and some other folks who are very, very open to innovation. Mm-hmm. And maybe their criticism is they're a little bit too experimental. And then I take that.
Mm-hmm.
But then over here, these people were sort of like trying to one up each other on purity tests. Like what's the pure thing? And they would have to almost by definition reject everything. Because if they accept any application, then it becomes a much more nuanced argument that, hey, why is this type of NFT okay, but that type not? Why is, like, you know, a stable coin okay, but not like a stable coin that's backed by a different type of cap or whatever, right? Then it becomes a nuanced type of a discussion, and there's no room for that. So the more extreme stances are actually in some ways easier to defend, that Bitcoin is only money, everything else is crap, don't think about it. And what happened was, because ordinals couldn't be rejected, they were right there in the L1. The funniest thing is that, you know, all the monetary maximalists are now storing monkey pictures on their Bitcoin nodes. They literally are. They're running Bitcoin nodes, and they can't do anything about it, right? Like they're storing it. So a lot of people are also, I think, from a cultural perspective, the more extreme you become, the more people you start losing as well. Like famously, I think Nick Carter is an example, who was sort of like, you know, attacked by the peer group, and kicked out. Let me admit this one thing, that I actually have been maintaining a Telegram channel of every prominent person who's been kicked out of those circles, and we welcome them, right? So it's like we've been silently sort of like growing the community of the non sort of like maximalist crowd, and I think it's been working really well. So I think the more they sort of like reject their own people as well, it actually helps the rest of the Bitcoin community and the Bitcoin builders community as well. So ordinals were, I think, the perfect thing, because L2s are easier to ignore. They're not like in your face like how ordinals were, because ordinals are now because of ordinals, like Bitcoin fees is going up, right? Bitcoin fees went up like 200x or something. And that is something that every time you go to a Bitcoin explorer, like mempool, dot space or whatever, you can't ignore it. Like you can't pretend that, you know, this thing is not Bitcoin.
So how has the developer community, like a lot of the pontificating, a lot of the noise, a lot of the infighting is between, you might describe them as like pundits or protocol politicians or I'm trying to be polite, so I'll move on. Just people who are maybe not super technical. What does the developer community look like? What's your sense of the extent to which people who are actually building in Bitcoin are sort of more aligned with this more liberal or more open view of what it can do and should do?
Yeah, so I think the interesting part was, I think the harder thing was getting started, right? So if there is no developer community and any new developer shows up and just gets yelled at and gets discouraged, I do think, like, you know, some Bitcoiners would say like, oh no, it shouldn't impact you. Bitcoin is free and open, do whatever you want. No, I think it impacts people, like if they get that sort of a treatment, especially when there's so many other ecosystems that are much more friendly and they can go there. But so we focused on initially creating like at least a critical sort of like a community of developers so that they can start supporting each other. And I think that was very helpful. Another thing we did was, like, for example, we organized this Bitcoin Builders Conference right next to Bitcoin Miami. So Bitcoin Miami is like where the monetary crowd is going, but we have our own dev sort of like event right next to it. And then we invited all the different L2s like Rootstock and a lot of people from Lightning and others. And these people, once you're in person, they realize that, hey, we have much more in common with each other than anything else. And then there's strength in numbers, right? Like if there are a lot of L2s, then there is strength in numbers. So I think those things started helping developers. And when they come and go like, oh, okay, maybe I like the design trade-offs of this L2 more than the other L2, but at least it starts emerging as a category. And then the thing that really helped was, let me take a step back. So one mental framework that I really like is I try to separate out BTC, the asset, from Bitcoin, the rails. Mm-hmm. And I think it sort of like perfectly describes the current situation where these monetary maximalists really believe in BTC as money and as the asset, which is totally fine, right? Like I share that belief with them. I am a Bitcoin monetary maximalist. I keep all my savings in Bitcoin, and I've been doing that for like 10 years now, right? So I share that thing with them. Where we disagree is that I think Bitcoin rails can be upgraded, especially through L2s, right? Like you don't have to change the L1 that much, or maybe not at all. But Bitcoin, the rails can be upgraded. They can be faster, they can be cheaper, there can be all sorts of use cases that are deployed there. And BTC, the Bitcoin capital...
doesn't need to change.
Yes. So the L1 doesn't need to change much, right? And BTC, the capital can be deployed and can be made productive, right? And it will make Bitcoin more valuable. And I think that's the argument that can actually speak to some of these folks as well. Like just like they are supportive of the ETFs. Why? Because ETFs are sort of like taking supply off of the market and Bitcoin demand is going up. Bitcoin L2s are actually very similar because Bitcoin L2s are taking capital away from other places and from the market, and it's being deployed inside the L2s and it's being made productive. That actually makes Bitcoin more valuable. And then outside of the industry, like in the rest of crypto, Ethereum, Solana, like the people would criticize Bitcoin the rails and Bitcoin the dev tooling environment and the developer community. Even they believe that Bitcoin, the asset, is actually like a pristine asset, right? So once you separate these two things out, it actually becomes much easier to agree with people. Like with the monetary maximalists, you completely agree that Bitcoin, the asset, is great. Everyone nods heads. Same with even the outside of Bitcoin crowd. A lot of people would agree with you that Bitcoin, the asset, is sort of like really like the pristine asset in our industry. And then you sort of like paint the picture that, you know, rails can be upgraded. There can be all sorts of different L2s. And Bitcoin is going to live on like multiple L2s, just like it lives on Ethereum. And I think that's where some technical arguments come in. So I should mention this because it's important. It's a little bit too technical, but I think I'll try to keep it at a higher level. So basically, after you have this framing and people sort of nod heads, the next criticism, the biggest criticism that has been there is the Ethereum folks would say, that Bitcoin L1 doesn't have the necessary support to have trustless L2s, right? So there's some sort of a bridge or a multisig in the middle, and that's why these L2s are not going to be as trustless as Ethereum, and they're not going to take off. And I think the biggest thing that happened recently was there's a project called BitVM, which is effectively what it can do is that without changing Bitcoin L1, it can enable trustless bridges, like almost trustless. Like I wouldn't get into security properties, but you're 99% of the way there. And I think once these trustless L2s are enabled through BitVM, that's the last straw. That's the last missing piece of the puzzle. And that's the biggest criticism that people had in the Ethereum world and so on. And once they see that, I think even the bigger critics would be like, okay, I think now Bitcoin L2s are a category and they're here to stay.
How can you break down the ways in which the different layer twos in Bitcoin are approaching scaling and approaching sort of building out this layer on top of Bitcoin? If you look at Lightning, Liquid, Stax, and Rootstock.
Yeah. So I think that's the right way to think about it. I think the way to categorize them is that they are the big fours. Just call them the OGs or the big fours, which is, you know, Stax, Lightning, Rootstock, and Liquid. And then there is a fresh crop coming. I think maybe within the next 6 months, we'll say four or five other projects launch. Some of them are even more public already, like Babylon and SpiderChain and others. And then I think there's the bigger crop coming, which is like 15 or 20 more L2s, and they're going to experiment with all sorts of different design. And I think that's great. I welcome all the competition. I welcome, because I think this category just needs to grow by a lot. And it's sort of like still pretty early and pretty small right now. So in terms of the big four, they're all very different. Lightning is sort of like the most popular one. And it's in terms of dev community, I think Stax and Lightning communities are sort of similar as measured by the Electric Capital Report, for example. But Lightning focuses on peer-to-peer payments and just payments mostly, right? So it doesn't have smart contracts. So if you're used to building on Solana or Ethereum, where you can pretty much program anything, that's not what Lightning is. Lightning is just for payments, and it's peer-to-peer, so it doesn't have a blockchain, it doesn't have any history. So it's a very targeted like payments protocol, and it's getting some use, and it's great out there. Then I think there's Liquid, which is, it still doesn't have a fully expressive language, but they can have it if they want mm-hmm. to. But the main difference is that it's a federation, right? So you're trusting Blockstream and a couple of partners. Mm-hmm. So you're sending Bitcoin to a multisig that they operate, and the network is also run by them. Right? Mm-hmm. But then the question would be, why are they running a federation? The answer is that they don't have a token, right? So there's no incentive other than the parties who fully control the network to sort of like run it. And then I think Rootstock and Stacks is what most people in Ethereum and Solana would think of as L2s, because they're fully programmable. Rootstock is EVM compatible. Stacks has a safer programming language called Clarity, but they're fully programmable. You can do whatever you want, and they have sort of like open mining. Rootstock tries to share hash power with Bitcoin miners. I think they have, depending on when you measure it, but between 40 to 50% of the Bitcoin hash power on Rootstock. And Stacks is a different mechanism. There's one that's live today, and the one that's going live with the Nakamoto launch is that every sort of like, it has fast blocks. So between two Bitcoin blocks, you can do fast blocks. And then they all settle on Bitcoin when the Bitcoin block comes. So for someone to reorg transactions on Stacks, they would have to go back and attack Bitcoin miners, meaning that it inherits like 100% of Bitcoin reorg resistance just by the way it's designed. And then I think if you look at sort of like market caps, ETH L2s are at 80 billion like mm-hmm. today in liquid FDV. And I think Bitcoin L2s are like 5 billion and Stacks is probably 95% of it, right? So in terms of, you know, startups built or capital raise, like I do think like the Stacks ecosystem tends to attract a lot of like sophisticated developers or investors and people who are sort of like really pragmatic, and they want to ship things and build stuff that that a lot of users can use. So I feel very sort of like fortunate to be in this ecosystem, but I want this category to be like 100 billion, 200 billion category, right? And which is only going to happen if like, you know, 20 other projects enter, a lot more capital comes in, and that would actually keep people in Stacks on their toes as well, right? Like, because there's a lot more competition and they need to focus on like delivering the best products.
How would you say people are using, or rather what the profile of users, how is it different maybe from Ethereum? What type of, when you look at the 80 billion versus the 5 billion, how is that activity maybe different or coming from different types of groups?
Yeah. So I think the way to think about this is a great case study to have is the Ordinals data, mm-hmm. right? So Ordinals, I think within 6 months was able to flip Ethereum NFT trading volume. And I think it's been able to sustain that as well. So a lot of people thought, hey, just a blip, right? You know, maybe there's a spike in interest and it's going to go away. But no, I think consistently, Bitcoin, like imagine came out of nowhere after years. And it was right up there with Ethereum and Solana in terms of trading volume. Sometimes Bitcoin is number one, sometimes Solana is, sometimes Ethereum is. That's the high level takeaway. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at the type of people who are doing it, I think a lot of them are also folks who came from Ethereum and Solana to Bitcoin. And if you go on Twitter spaces and talk to these people, they go like, hey, I always had a soft corner for Bitcoin. I actually think it's the least risky asset. I always keep Bitcoin, but I've never had anything to do with my Bitcoin, right? Like if you keep Bitcoin in like cold storage on Electrum, there are only two things you can do with it. Either do a transaction or do nothing, like just hold. And I think they just never had the opportunity of ever making a trade into an NFT or something using BTC. And Ordinal sort of enabled that. And I think like that's, so I would say it there are two categories. One is people who hold BTC or mostly in the Bitcoin ecosystem, and now they have new things to do. But it's also people who are in other ecosystems who are getting pulled back in. And I sort of call it like they're coming back to the mothership now, right? So that's interesting. And on the DeFi side, I think it's, I would say in terms of like even looking at the value of the L2s, the main thing missing right now is BTC capital being deployed in these L2s, because all of the various bridges are in various stages of development or use right now. Like for example, Stacks, the main thing is not even live, right? So Stacks has one major upgrade coming divided into two hard forks. So Nakamoto launches the fast blocks, and then there's SBDC, which is the trust minimized bridge. So I think once BTC capital can be deployed into L2s, specifically in Stacks, others are at different stages as well, I think then the TVL actually grows. And I think market caps are sort of like a function of that, right? Like how much economic activity is there, how much TVL is there, and then the market cap. In the Ethereum case, ETH is a widely deployed asset already, right? Mm-hmm. So when these L2s launch, people actually know that a bunch of ETH capital is going to move in because they have evidence, right? Even if a new L2 is launching, the average sort of like market value of a good ETH L2 is already up there because people have seen that happen. I think on the Bitcoin side, one data point that we really need to prove out is BTC deployed into the L2s. And I think once that happens, then it's a very, very clear picture for everyone in the industry that, okay, this is a category, it's growing, it's sort of like not going away. Some would even argue, like I've even seen Ethereum people make the case that they are less concerned about alt L1s like Solana and others. And they think that the industry could evolve into a, just like, you know, we have Apple and Microsoft, like two big players.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be Bitcoin and Ethereum. So there are people who are looking at, if Bitcoin L2s actually work, there's already like $1 trillion in capital. If it starts getting deployed in L2s, then they might become a more important category than the alt L1s. And I can sort of like see that reasoning.
Mm. What do you think about a bunch of new Bitcoin roll-ups coming up to compete?
Yeah, I think they're very interesting. My high-level stance is that I want to see every iteration and different remixes of design being experimented with on Bitcoin and see what actually works. So the roll-up side, the reason why I personally am not doing like a lot of R&D right now, there are plans in the Stacks ecosystem to look at roll-ups R&D as well. The reason why I personally and some of the other core devs are, you know, focused on the faster confirmations of the L2 internal consensus is because Bitcoin is not going to change, right? And Bitcoin has like a 10 to 40 minute single confirmation time, but something like 6 blocks until things become final. It's the probabilistic finality, but 6 blocks. So what that means is that you have a 1 hour to 2 hour window in which finality is going to happen at the base L1 layer. It's not the case with Ethereum. Ethereum can actually, because of proof of stake and no forking, Ethereum can reach finality very, very fast at the L1 level. So some of these rollups actually are more practical because you don't have to wait very long for finality on the L1, right? So it doesn't mean like there's a separate thing that these rollups are going to require some changes to Bitcoin. Maybe BitVM sidesteps that. It's work in progress. But regardless, I think that these rollups would have a greater need for internal L2 consensus and initial fast confirmations than some of the stuff on Ethereum, right? So if those people have to work on like, you know, internal fast confirmations anyway, Stacks is already doing that work, right? Like we have to design, that's what the Nakamoto launch is
about. That's what's going to be released in the next, I guess.
Exactly. So I think that's where the focus is. Same with BitVM. I'm, I think, one of the biggest advocates of BitVM outside of the core team right now. I think we're going to try and support that effort, even potentially fund it with some R&D. There's some conversations going on. But the high-level takeaway is if BitVM works and is clearly a better way to design bridges, I think most L2s are going to start using BitVM, right? So we are right now focused on shipping something that has really good practical security and can sort of like kickstart the Bitcoin DeFi ecosystem on the Stacks L2. And as better bridge designs become available with BitVM, you can always do an upgrade. You can always do an upgrade to the bridge, and we want to be on the cutting edge of it. So that's sort of like the approach we're taking. I think what I would say is, you're asking about the developer community in Bitcoin versus Ethereum. One thing I have noticed is that, yes, they're very mission-driven people here, but sometimes they're a little too idealistic as well, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I like about the Stacks ecosystem is that people are much more pragmatic. They can focus on like, hey, let's ship something that works today and try to grow the user base and developers, versus waiting for the perfect solution or you know, designing a perfect system that doesn't have a token. Like there's an obsession that a lot of these projects have where they want to have all the features but not have a token, which is almost like an oxymoron, right? Like if you are, it's a trade-off. Like if you don't have the incentives, you're designing a different system. And that system is going to look very different from all these other chains out there like Solana and Ethereum that clearly have an incentive structure where people can have validators. The number of times that I get the question that why is there a token, I even have like personal FAQ pages that I just paste the link and I'm like, go read this. It's a trade-off. You can either run a federation like Liquid and don't have a token, or you can run an open system like Solana or Ethereum, where there are incentives for validators to run the thing.
What's the sort of counter argument?
I think the counter argument has mostly been the overreaction to scams in the industry, right? Like where, if you look at, again, going back to the political leaders and the monetary maximus crowd, they, when the bull markets happen and there all these projects are going up in value, they're drumming the beat that no, Bitcoin is the only thing, these things are going to blow up. Sure, if you call like 100 things that they're going to blow up, a lot of them are actually going to blow up, but not everything, right? And whenever a scam happens, they're like, look, that's why you should buy Bitcoin. Like, I think a much saner argument, which like I remember from the OG crowd, it's actually funny like how little my personal sort of like recommendation and allocation has shifted. I remember in 2013, 2014, people would normally say that, look, you want to keep like 80% of your capital in BTC and have like 10 to 20% experimental stuff that you throw around, learn new things, and, you know, treat that as a more risky capital. Some of it is going to blow up. Some of them might be like a early tech investment that you got lucky on and so on. And I think I would even today look at it in a similar way that, as I said, I use BTC for savings, right? Like most of my savings is in BTC. If I want to deploy some capital in risky things, like, sure, why not? Like, why are you obsessing over people's ability to make, you know, their own decisions? Like, if they want to do it, let them do it. So I think that's where some of the token brainwashing is coming from, that they start thinking that these tokens are somehow taking value away from Bitcoin. So that has been one of the biggest hurdles for me when I try to educate people, because I am trying to tell all of the Bitcoin community that these different apps and use cases and tokens can actually add value to Bitcoin, because they will trade against BTC. Like, people would take their profits and bring it back to BTC. They would actually result in a Bitcoin circular economy, at least online, when you're trading against NFTs and these other sort of like DeFi protocols and so on. So that argument is very hard, but I think if we can articulate it well, where people start seeing, even if somebody believes this is a casino, but they view the casino as being good for the BTC economy, then I think the attitude becomes different versus viewing the casinos as something evil and something that's extracting value out of Bitcoin for some reason.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm trying to think of another. I'm trying to build on that casino analogy, but I don't want to fall on my face trying to do it. But I get what you're saying. Can you walk us through what the next like 6 to 12 months look like for Trust Network and or Trust Machine and Stax, and what folks should expect?
Yeah. So I think there, as I said, it's a very decentralized ecosystem, a lot of independent entities, but a lot of them are sort of feeling like, mm-hmm. hey, the next Nakamoto upgrade is very critical, right? Like it's going to massively increase the block times. It's going to increase the network capacity. So interestingly, Stax today is actually running at maximum capacity. Like mempool is full. Devs are yelling at core devs that, hey, we need more, kind of like more network capacity to be able to do more transactions and so on. So I think a lot of people are sort of like waiting for it. And because the ecosystem is so decentralized, there's no equivalent of a Solana Labs that is just doing all the work. So the ecosystem had to learn how to come together in an open source way through these working groups and contribute to open source code, which I do think sometimes slows things down as well. There's definitely an overhead, right? Like if multiple people have to collaborate that way. But that, I think, is in the back view mirror already. Nakamoto launch and SBDC are pretty like, they're like months out. So once that happens, Trust Machine has been working on a bunch of interesting products that we want to launch, right? So that's the thing that we are super excited about. Like, we are viewing Nakamoto launch as, you know, end users would get to experience a high quality, fast, and cheap L2. And I don't think that most of people have experienced that. I think the closest experience that they would have had would be on Lightning, which still, you know, sometimes not as reliable as you would ideally want it to be. But because Stacks is a blockchain-based system, right, like there are no liquidity issues, there are no sort of like routing issues. If you're making a simple thing as a quick BTC payment, it should go through like pretty much all of the time, as long as
it's just very manual, isn't it? Lightning.
Yeah, it's basically, I think the analogy I give is like, yes, Solana gets criticized sometimes for being too centralized or whatever, but the UX is great, right? Like, yes, it goes down once in a while, but most of the times users are getting fast, cheap payments done and they don't have to think about anything. They don't have to think about liquidity. They don't have to think about routes. So bringing that sort of experience with maybe even more reliability to a Bitcoin L2 could actually upgrade the UX of Bitcoin throughout the world, right? Like this is, I do think that people would use BTC by default on L2s and not on the L1. L1 I view as something where when you want to put your BTC in cold storage or you're dealing with very large amounts of BTC, like let's say ETF is buying BTC from a large exchange or something, that's when those things would happen. I do think ordinals with high value NFTs would still store data on the L1. But most of the NFTs, the long tail, they're not that high value, right? So those might live on the L2s. And Stacks, for example, automatically hashes all the L2 data on the L1, which is something NFTs are using already, right? So there are inscriptions on Stacks, which are sort of cheaper because you're not on the L1, but at least the hashes are on L1 and the data is in the L2. So I think that this, the more clear the function of L1 and L2 becomes, I think the better it's going to be for Bitcoin as a whole. And this is another thing where I find some bonds with the monetary maximalist crowd, because a lot of them want to see Bitcoin ossify. They want Bitcoin to stop changing. But like, we're done. We just don't need any changes. And then I try to walk them through how a healthy ecosystem of L2s is how you ossify Bitcoin. Because the only thing you need to figure out is good support for the L2s. Once you figure that out, most of the experimentation is actually going to happen on the L2. If you're running out of capacity, for example, instead of increasing more capacity on the L1, you would just upgrade the L2 to increase the network capacity.
Yeah. And so the change is really happening on that secondary layer, not at the bottom foundation.
Yes.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join the program. We really appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon. It's a lot happening.
I know. There's a lot. This was, I think the timing worked out really well. We talked when the Bitcoin ecosystem was actually taking off.
We love a good Bitcoin episode here at The Scoop.
Awesome. Thanks so much, man. Great chatting.
Take care. And The Scoop will be back for you with another great guest. Have an awesome day.